I'm Christopher Lydon with Andrew Bacevich at Boston University. He is a West Point-trained Army officer turned historian and policy critic. I come to him in this agitated spring of an election year searching for storylines that the presidential candidates won't give us about whatever it is we're going through. The story, Andrew Bacevich says, in a compelling book of essays he's edited, is it's the end of the American century. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Andrew Bacevich, you call it the short American century, a 70-year century from 1941 and World War II to Iraq and the now endless wars in and around the Middle East. You say our place at the summit of the world is gone. And I take it halfway personally. You and I are children of the American century. I'm tempted to say, the American century has been very, very good to me. What made you decide that the era is over, and also that you wished it good riddance?
I wish it good riddance only in the sense that I think we would do well to recognize the world as it is and as it is becoming, rather than to insist on a world that pretend that this American century still exists when it's ended. Now, why do I think it's ended? I believe that by 2008, the end of the American century had become clear for two reasons. The first reason was the onset of the Great Recession, this enormous economic crisis that has caused so much suffering and distress in the country. But perhaps even more importantly, by 2008, it had become clear that the George W. Bush freedom agenda, the notion that through the use or the concerted use of American military power, the United States could transform the greater Middle East, that project had obviously failed. And I say that was the more important of the two issues because, to my mind, in the wake of the Cold War, Americans had come to believe that military supremacy was the principal remaining prop sustaining the American century. And therefore, the military failure signified by the Iraq War suggested that even that prop had become so weakened that the American century simply was no longer a sustainable proposition.
Take it back to Henry Luce. Life magazine, 1941. What was the American century? I mean, I reread that piece thanks to your book. We were going to make American democracy a world thing. We were going to take it international, and we did.
Yeah, let me, the phrase American century was one coined by Henry Luce in this famous essay that appeared in Life magazine in February of 1941. And maybe there's a little bit of stage setting here that ought to be done.
Sure.
Of course, Luce, now pretty much a forgotten figure, I guess, in his day was a titanic figure on the national stage.
Dare we say the Arianna Huffington of his time or something?
I actually think that Arianna Huffington is an insignificant figure compared to Luce, the creator with a partner of time. The creator without any partner of fortune and then of life. I mean, he was a genuine media mogul.
Then Sports Illustrated. People Magazine.
People.
Big time.
Big time. And he was an interesting person, raised in China, the son of American missionaries who served in China. Somebody who, as a consequence of his upbringing, had a lifelong affinity for and interest in and concern for China and the belief that the United States had a mission to make China like America, but also somebody who as an adult had a peculiar religious sensibility. Now, he actually converted to Catholicism after his marriage to Claire Booth. He was not an Orthodox Catholic, but he was somebody in whose mind religious considerations and political considerations merged. And that merger is very much expressed in this essay. Now, as I said, the essay comes out in February 1941. February 1941, World War II has been underway for a year and a half. In the European War, the Nazis are on the march. Indeed, in February of 1941, Britain stands alone against the Third Reich. This country is deeply divided over the question of whether or not we should become involved. Many Americans in 1941 are persuaded that the U.S. involvement in the previous World War had been a catastrophic mistake, and they are not eager to repeat that mistake. Many other Americans, millions of them, are absolutely persuaded that for both strategic and moral reasons, it's important for the country to get involved. Luce is in that camp. He wants the United States to intervene. And the purpose of this essay, the American Century essay, is to try to make an authoritative statement to persuade doubting Americans that the cause is one that has to be our cause. But the essay doesn't simply say, the Nazis are bad guys, the Brits represent democracy, let's intervene in the war. Rather, what the essay says is that the American moment has now arrived, that the opportunity to exercise world leadership is ours, the obligation to exercise global leadership is ours. So the purpose of the essay is not simply to argue for intervention in World War II, but to now don the mantle that, in Luce's view, has always been our intended role, intended by history, intended by God, to begin the process now of Americanizing the world. That's what the American Century is all about. Now, I don't think, actually, in 1941, although the essay attracted a certain amount of attention, it didn't particularly resolve this debate over World War II. The Japanese resolved the debate over World War II when they bombed Pearl Harbor. But by 1945, when the smoke clears and the war has ended, it does appear that an American century has now begun. Because as a consequence of World War II, and thanks largely to the folly of Adolf Hitler and to the strength of the Red Army, the United States does indeed stand at the summit of global power. Whether viewed politically or militarily or economically. And so the phrase that he coined back in 1941 does become a phrase that seems, in the eyes of many people, to describe a reality in the post-war era. And as you said, that's the era when our generation is growing up. And if you had the good fortune to be born white and to a family that either was in the middle class or achieved entry into the middle class, it was a pretty good time. I mean, it was a time of enormous prosperity, of relative political stability, a time when, for the most part, the United States was insulated from the difficulties that existed in other parts of the world. So I personally am not suggesting that there had never been an American century. I'm less certain that we ought to celebrate the American century, but I do believe that the American century has ended, and therefore, from a historian's perspective, we are now in a position where we can say, well, now that it's over, what was it all about? What did it mean? What did it yield?
Before we bury it, I mean, let's give it its due. I'm reminded by your book, three things stick in my mind. We came out of the war intact, militarily, but industrially. We'd cranked out those B-29s for years and built up the biggest industrial machine ever in the world. Also, credit a certain American talent for multilateral dealing after the war. The Marshall Plan, the United Nations itself, all the financial structures of the great post-war expansion. I'd also add, in a big way, the cultural piece. I mean, this was bebop time. It was explosive time in movies, in books, in popular culture, in serious culture, and it all related. If I had to say, for me, the high point of the American century was Duke Ellington's last tour of the Soviet Union in 1971, and I've met guys, Russians, who sat in with that band, and it was the high point of their life. A culture of huge vitality and quality that stands up and did for many, many years. So what happened? What happened to the industrial might, to the multilateral instincts of the United States, and and this incredibly charismatic culture?
That is a very good question, and I don't think that there's a simple answer that I can offer. One answer, I think, is that the position that we had come to enjoy in 1945 was impossible to sustain that. It was artificial. It was a direct result of World War II. And either the self-destructiveness of others, Germany and Japan, or the decline of previous powers, Great Britain, France, and the like. So there's a very peculiar circumstance. I mean, in 1946, we produce half of the wealth of the entire globe. You referenced churning out B-29s. And of course, with remarkable alacrity, the economy converted after the war. And so assembly lines that had been producing B-29s were now producing DC-4s and DC-7s and automobiles and television sets and this cornucopia of consumer goods that made the American way of life the envy of the rest of the world. But in some senses, the seeds of our undoing, to some degree, were right there in that conversion to a consumer economy, or the embrace of consumerism. Mm. Because we came to believe as a people that, first of all, that material consumption defined the road to happiness, that trying to satisfy these appetites of ours for material goods, to do that meant that you embraced a marketplace view of the world in which the acquisition of goods at the lowest possible price became one of the principal drivers of policy. And although for a time in the 1950s, we could produce all of these goods more efficiently and cheaply than others, it was probably inevitable that other economies would displace us, as has been the case, first by Japan, in a sense, and in the present moment by China. So we here, we Americans, still want all that stuff that we coveted back in the 1950s. But back in the 1950s, the stuff was produced by American workers and therefore was a source of generating wealth and therefore power. Today, we want the stuff, and the stuff comes from China. The wealth is being generated in China, and we are saddling ourselves with debt as a consequence of that. And we refuse to change the way we live because the way we live tends to be centered on the acquisition of material goods. That's one explanation for why this decline occurs.
But again, credit the good news of that post-war expansion in the famous Walter Reuther Ford deal and understanding that we were going to pay people wages so that they could afford to buy those cars.
That was then, this is now. Right. And today, the, I think, far more commonplace attitude of Americans is to view unions as a problem, as an obstacle, as a barrier to the sort of efficiency, meaning produce things at the lowest possible cost, that tends to be more of a driving sentiment. I mean, I agree with you completely that in their heyday, unions were powerful and I think on balance positive in their impact on American society, but that heyday is long gone.
That's part of what we got to figure out. Part of the spur for me in these conversations, Andrew Bacevich, is Tony Judt and his last book of sort of Jeremiah warnings called Ill Fares the Land. His lament is for the social democracy that we enjoyed after World War II, well into the 70s, including that social contract with labor so that they could afford to be players across the board. Those days lasted 30 years after the war. I grew up in that atmosphere of shared well-being based on incredible abundance, but also on public schools, public transport, things like that, and then the civil rights movement, and then the continuous expansion of women's roles, women's rights, this kind of thing. It started to come apart in the 70s, I think, and then seemed to get buried under culture of greed, the me decades. What was the me decade? They went on forever.
But the me decades, the greed, didn't come out of nowhere. It was, in a sense, a perverse extension of the attitudes that did exist in the 1950s and 1960s. But let me circle back to your maybe slightly rose-tinted memory of, you know, being in this together, but only slightly rose-tinted. And I think here too is you come back to an appreciation for the significant impact of World War II in ending the Depression. World War II re-legitimizes American institutions. In the Depression, it wasn't simply that there was great want and suffering. During the Depression, a considerable number of Americans really began to question whether our system of liberal democratic capitalism was sustainable. The 30s were a decade of considerable radicalism. That is to say, there were lots of people, well, some numbers of people, who basically said, this American system is broken. It doesn't work. Right. World War II demonstrated that the American system could work. And therefore, the country that emerges from the war is a country of people who once again believe. They believe in democracy. They believe in capitalism. Free enterprise is the term that people would prefer. And I think that's a source, that's a part of the reinvigoration of American society produced by World War II that does create the conditions for what is an American century. And it does express itself in some ways in that energetic, innovative, popular culture that is so much a part of the 40s and 50s and 60s. And I think one of the things that happens by the time you get to what you call the me decades or the period of greed, and I don't dispute that characterization, is that we've used up that storehouse of legitimacy that emerged as a consequence of World War II.
When Tony Judt looks at our world today in this country and says, ill fares the land, quoting Oliver Goldsmith, ill fares the land to hastening ills a prey where wealth accumulates and men decay. When he looks out on that scene, he thinks, oh, for the social democracy, the atmosphere of opportunity, the support for education, public transportation, eventually for civil rights, that expanded our base. I'm wondering where his critique of that breakdown, that erosion of assumptions about the society as one, an American way of life that had to be sustained by a lot of public investment and regulation and work together, how does that fit with your picture of the eroding American century here and abroad?
Well, let me come at it from maybe a slightly different angle and introduce a new character into the conversation. And the character I'd want to introduce is Jimmy Carter. And in particular, the Jimmy Carter of the summer of 1979 when he gave his famous Malaise speech, which doesn't include the word Malaise, but a speech that I think is one of the most important ever given by an American president, both because of what he said, the context in which he said it, but also because of the way it was received. And let's recall what the context was. Here we are in the 1970s, post-Vietnam. Vietnam not forgotten by any means, still something of a seeping wound on the American body politic. The American economy going through a very rough patch. Remember the term stagflation? Mm. A stagnant economy combined with very, very high inflation. The shock of oil dependency coming home. It had, of course, already in 1973. At the time he is making his speech, we're in the midst of a second oil shock. A country that values mobility and takes for granted that energy should exist in abundant supply and be very cheap suddenly confronts the fact that a gallon of gas costs a hell of a lot of money, compounded by the fact of the Iranian Revolution and the emergence of this new regime hostile to the United States and, of course, the hostage crisis. Jimmy Carter's going on TV to explain what this all signifies, what the country needs to do, and, of course, by extension, why he should be voted for a second term in office. And the speech he gives is a speech about American values. And the speech he gives is one in which he decries the emergence of materialism, of an overemphasis on stuff, and a turning away from the traditional values that he believed provided the foundation of the Republic, and probably values that one might say enjoyed particularly emphasis in that post-war period that we've been talking about. And what Jimmy Carter said is, we need to turn away from these false values back to true values. And in order to do that, we need to change the way we live. And you, the American people, I want you to sacrifice. I want you to forego your materialistic ways. Follow me to the New Jerusalem. And of course, he was hooted and derided and laughed at. And indeed, within 6 months, had himself abandoned that line of reasoning. And instead, January 1980, articulated what came to be known as the Carter Doctrine, which in many respects launches the country off on a trajectory in which, instead of trying to resolve our dependence upon foreign oil by moving towards energy independence, we opt instead to employ American military power to control the region of the world from which oil comes. And that option has, of course, led to a whole sequence of costly military misadventures that bring us to the present moment where we're still dependent upon oil. It costs more than it ever did. And yet we still can cling basically to the sense of what the American way of life should be that we subscribed to back in the 1970s. I think that's an important explanation for why the American century has come to an end, because we as a people refuse to take seriously the warnings that Jimmy Carter issued way back then at the end of the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cut ahead in 2009 to Barack Obama's inaugural speech, in which he said, I'm not going to apologize. We're not going to be put on the defensive for our way of life. But long before then, the three at least key elements of the decline of the American century you're writing about are established. One is the non-restraint of military power, most especially in Vietnam. Another is an abandonment of multilateralism certly in Iraq, which the world sees as a illegal unilateral military action by us. And we've abandoned a lot of moral high ground by that time, too, in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. And third, the empire of production of the late 40s has become an empire of consumption. So who are you mad at in the end? And what's our emotion here about the damage done to America on high?
I'm mad at us. I have come to believe that we are badly ill-served by the political class, a term encompassing Republicans as well as Democrats. That said, Republicans and Democrats are doing what they think we want done. I think that to a very large extent, the fundamentals of U.S. policy, this overemphasis on military power, the imperial urges that manifest themselves in preposterous efforts to control large parts of the world, even that unilateralism that you decry and that I would also decry, reflect the political class interpreting what they think we want. And I think that that interpretation is an accurate one. Now, in your positive view of the American century, you would identify multilateralism as a component of what made that period a positive one. And I think you're right in a sense, except that, of course, from the get-go, it was a multilateralism in which the United States was going to assert for itself the prominent role. I mean, enthusiasm for the United Nations at its founding was not an enthusiasm that wished to turn the international order over to Colombia, Ecuador, and Bolivia. It was a multilateralism that assumed that this would be an institution in which the United States would be able to exercise a predominant voice, yeah, and that the Bolivians and the Ecuadorians would would go along. And to some degree, that was correct. Maybe a better example than the UN would be NATO, where, yes, of course, it's an alliance of equals, except that it's not really. I mean, when was the last time we had a supreme allied commander in Europe, a NATO military commander, who was not an American four-star officer? And the answer is we've never had a SACEUR who was not an American four-star officer. The problem, I think, happens that by the time you get to the first decade of the 21st century, the world is not going to collaborate in this kind of false multilateralism that serves as a camouflage for American preeminence. And particularly when somebody like George W. Bush says, in the aftermath of 9/11, there is a new world in which the United States is going to implement a doctrine of preventive war to keep itself safe, other nations are not willing to go along with that. So yes, we abandon multilateralism, but we abandon it because the conditions no longer exist for us to pretend to be multilateral while mostly doing what we want to do.
Andrew, think of all the years we spent arguing about who lost China. When it comes right down to it, nominate a candidate or two as a scapegoat for, you know, who lost our century.
Well, again, my real vote is that to recognize the fact that we collectively are implicated in the path that we've chosen to go down. That said, I think that I'd probably nominate the post-Cold War presidents as a group. The remilitarization of U.S. foreign policy.
And that gets you Reagan, H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton too.
Emphatically Bill Clinton too. I mean, what I was about to say is that Reagan's role, of course, is to revise the image of the American military and of the American soldier, in a sense to banish the negative image that came from Vietnam. George Herbert Walker Bush's contribution was to inaugurate a new era of interventionism in Panama, certainly in the first Persian Gulf War, but also not to be forgotten by any means in Somalia, sort of his going away gift to the nation. But I would very much then include Bill Clinton in my list of villains, because it really is during the Clinton era, this draft dodger of the Vietnam era, this person who seemed to represent the inverse of a militarist. But it's Bill Clinton who becomes more promiscuous in his use of American military power than any preceding president. You know, up in the ante in Somalia, intervention in Haiti, intervention in Bosnia, intervention in Kosovo, any number of sort of dust-ups with Saddam Hussein. It's under Bill Clinton that the United States begins to use the military in more places, for more purposes, more frequently than had ever been the case. That's then the circumstance that George W. Bush inherits, and I certainly don't want to let him off the hook. But to understand the hubris of George W. Bush's vision for a global war on terrorism that is going to liberate the Islamic world, that vision is rooted in expectations about the efficacy of military power that grew out of the Clinton years and the years when his father was president. So all these people, I think, should plead guilty to the charge of abusing and misusing American military power. And I would argue that the abuse of American military power accelerated the end of the American century.
And then, of course, we come to Barack Hussein Obama, who just in his charm and his handsome brown face kind of hinted at a soft landing for an empire in crisis. But he also promised a restoration of a rule of law and a reconciliation with Islam, but then surged in Afghanistan and Libya. He's the drone war president by now, who still hasn't closed Guantanamo. Where's the pattern going?
It continues. I mean, I think you've summarized the Obama record very nicely. The expectation of people who voted for Obama, that certainly would include me, was that his ascendance to the presidency would mark a fairly substantial change, a break in the trajectory, a break in this trajectory of ever-increasing emphasis on the use of military power to try to sustain what remains of the American century. And he has been a major disappointment. Now, he would say, hey, I promised to end the Iraq War, and I did end the Iraq War. And I think I would respond by saying, yes, Mr. President, but in addition to doing that, you both expanded and prolonged the Afghanistan War. You expanded the Afghanistan War into Pakistan. You opened up new fronts in this supposed global war on terror in Yemen, in Somalia. A couple weeks ago, there was a drone strike in the Philippines. And none of that, from the point of view of sound strategy or of recognizing the effective limits of military power, makes any sense whatsoever. So he is much more in line with the post-Cold War militaristic presidents than he is a departure from that tradition.
But so where are we? You say the American century is dead, but it's still running around the world with predator drones. And, is this a chicken after its head's been cut off, or has anything actually changed?
I think that's probably the right metaphor. I mean, we are running around the world, continuing to use hard power in questionable circumstances, yielding ambiguous results. And meanwhile, here at home, we've had, what is it now, 5 years or is it 6 years of trillion-dollar deficits? We've got a total national debt that is now larger than the total size of the American economy. Given the dysfunction in Washington, the dysfunction in Congress, the divisions between Republicans and Democrats, there doesn't seem to be any reasonable hope that we're going to get our own affairs in order anytime soon. So the empire, to my mind, is kind of running on fumes at this point. When, how, whether, you know, things will come to a crashing halt, I don't know. We certainly shouldn't underestimate the vast resources that are still available to this country, and we shouldn't underestimate our capacity for sort of muddling through difficult circumstances. But it really doesn't seem to me that the prospects are very promising at this point.
But I'm looking for a sort of reality check. I mean, I asked Simon Chummel once, how do empires end? When all the logic and all the real force, cultural, political, financial, is exhausted. He said they end in bankruptcy.
Well, I do think that we are hell-bent on bankrupting ourselves, but I don't know that there is any way, particular way, that empires end. To my mind, this empire is ending without, in a sense, Americans noticing it. But Washington still thinks it's the most important city in the world. Washington, people in Washington still think that the decisions that matter are made in Washington. I'm not sure that actually still conforms to reality. Decisions made in Beijing matter a whole heck of a lot now. And those decisions made there or in the capitals in India elsewhere are being made without, frankly, people paying much attention to what Washington thinks or Washington says. I guess to put it another way, remember at the end of the Cold War, there was all this chest thumping about the United States as the indispensable nation and the world's only superpower and that we were entering a unipolar moment. Well, those notions were probably fraudulent when they were first articulated at the end of the Cold War, but at this point, they're clearly obsolete. We are not living in a unipolar world. We are living in a world that is already multipolar. How many poles will ultimately count is a little bit difficult to say. How that multipolar world will work, whether it will be mostly stable and harmonious, or whether it will be unstable and filled with conflict, is impossible to say at this point. But whatever period we have entered, it's not a unipolar moment. And in that sense, the empire has, in a sense, already come to an end, even as people walk around in Washington persuading themselves that it's the decisions that are made there that are the ones that count.
I want to come to your several interesting notions of what's next or what's possible after this sort of situation. But deal first, Andrew Bacevich, with the other side. Robert Kagan's got it all in The World America Made, which will sell a lot of books. But the whole notion that it's American hegemony in the world or it's chaos, and that order in the world requires American power, even if we have to starve ourselves to sustain our military might.
Well, first of all, we're not going to starve ourselves. to maintain our military might. I mean, we as a people will insist that we can have it both ways, which is an illusion. Well, first of all, Kagan's book is itself a sort of an exercise in fiction, I think. It certainly is true that during the American century, we managed to avoid yet another world war, which would have been the last world war. And we ought to be very grateful for that. And certainly some credit for avoiding World War III accrues to the United States of America, just not quite as much credit as I think Kagan believes. A considerable amount of the credit, whether we like to acknowledge it or not, also goes to our adversary in the Cold War, namely the Soviet Union, and to the what Albert Wallstetter once called the delicate balance of terror that defined the relationship between ourselves and the Soviet Union, meaning a keen awareness on both sides that we needed to act in ways that would avoid a catastrophic nuclear confrontation. So it wasn't so much that the Americans endowed peace on the world. It was that Americans were partners with the Soviets in creating a adversarial relationship that was so dangerous that we and the Soviets, recognized the imperative of avoiding a calamitous armed confrontation. That's a sort of a peace, but only a sort of a peace. At the same time, within that peace, the avoidance of World War III that Kagan celebrates in his new book, there's a lot of bloodletting going on, some of which were part and parcel of Vietnam War, Korean War, much of which we stand aside and allow to happen. So in this golden age to which he credits America, we need to understand that there's a lot of people in that golden age that are suffering cruelties that sort of leave a little bit of tarnish on the gold.
Thinking of what comes next, it sounds almost too good to be true, but in this book, one of your contributors, Akira Irie, speaks of a transnational century. Transnational meaning the way I always think of this country, even from the beginning, before it was a nation, it was a country. It was a place to go. It was a place of dreams and freedom, right up to dreams from my father. Sort of everybody's nation, like the crew of the Pequod in Moby Dick, 41 countries represented, multi-languages, etc. That sort of transnational leadership is what Akira Irie outlines. And he summarizes it like this. The American century then was a time of intensive transnationalization, both of the world and of the United States, a period in which national boundaries ceased to inhibit the movement of people, goods, money, and ideas, in which different races and cultures amalgamated, and in which claims of national uniqueness began to dissipate. In the American century, the United States became less American. And you can see it on this campus at Boston University, any campus in the United States. We are a much less white guy country that you and I grew up in. And I think we celebrate it. But he ends, if the short American century is to have a successor, it will not be a Chinese century or an Indian century or a Brazilian century. It will be a long transnational century. Can you believe that?
Professor Irie is a fascinating and very distinguished figure. He's a professor emeritus of history at Harvard. And I think it's important to understand his personal story in appreciating this perspective. He was born and spent his boyhood in Japan, the Imperial Japan, the Japan of World War II. And he came here for schooling and made his professional life here at our most distinguished university. He is a transnational person. He is part of the phenomenon that he describes. And in this essay that you refer to, I mean, this is an essay in a collection, contributors of a wide variety of perspective, reflecting on what the short American century was all about. His perspective is one that emphasizes cultural exchange and intellectual exchange, in which, yes, unquestionably, remarkably, and I think on balance, certainly positively, the movement of ideas, the movement of cuisines, the movement of people academic exchange, tourism, all of these have just blossomed in remarkable ways. And he provides the details over the period since in World War II, enriching the lives of Americans, and I think probably, not probably, certainly, enriching the lives of people everywhere around the world. It's true you see it on our campus, but heck, you see it in any major American city. When I was a kid growing up outside Chicago, you went out to eat, it basically was the local steak place, and there was the local pizza parlor, and then there was a Chinese restaurant that advertised chop suey as the principal item on the menu. Today in an American city, there is no end to the range of cuisines that are available to you. And it is a wonderful thing. So I think there's a very powerful, important truth that he expresses here in describing the transnationalism that has been one aspect of this American century. I'm just not willing to go quite as far as he does, because it seems to me that the leaders of the People's Republic of China, the leaders of the United States of America down the road here in Washington, are going to continue to be insistent that there is a place called China that is different from America, there is a place called the United States that is different from China, and that they will each, these elites in these two countries, are going to define their particular national interests that will be, at least to some degree, at odds with the transnational convergence that he describes. Mm-hmm. So what he's given us is a very important and insightful truth. I think it's not the only truth to be taken from an evaluation of what the short American century was all about.
Mm. Andrew Bacevich, it goes without saying that neither of the final candidates for the president of the United States this year is going to embrace American decline, the end of the American century, or anything remotely like it. But coach people. First, how do you listen for little hints, little subliminal signals that they get some piece of this message? And then also, how would any of us make the insights you're giving us on the American century part of this 2012 campaign choice, even part of the wallpaper background in which we look at these? Well, this race.
I think that a recognition that the American century has ended will occur when we become serious about this notion of living within our means. And of course, that idea actually is floating out there in American politics. There is, I think, an increasing recognition that trillion-dollar deficits from now until the cows come home are not sustainable. Now, there's an argument about what causes the deficit, whether the fault is Democrats and their excessive spending for domestic programs, or Republicans and their excessive spending on military adventurism. The answer, of course, is it's both those things. But I think that what I would like to hear, don't expect to hear, as part of the debate over policy as we move toward the election, is serious consideration of how to address this gap. Whether it's tax reform, tax increases, more self-restraint in our use of military power, or finding ways to trim back the total entitlement bill. But beyond simply political posturing, what's the formula for solving that problem? If there is no serious formula for solving the problem, then the problem is going to persist. And it's going to get worse. And we will indeed bankrupt ourselves. What I want to hear from the candidates is serious talk about how we are going to become a people living within our means, living within history, rather than expecting that we can have it all and determine the course of history.
Could you preach that sermon to either the Tea Party or the Occupy movement, or possibly even to both?
I doubt it, because I think on both ends of the spectrum, there's going to have to be some give. My personal view is that there are principled people in both camps, but their principles are perhaps too rigid to provide the basis for a plausible program. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to see how they can find common ground, because in both of those camps, it seems to me that there's an ideological edge which makes compromise difficult.
Andrew Bacevich, thank you. It's always a challenge, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Chris.
Andrew Bacevich's new book, with eight other contributors, is titled The Short American Century, A Postmortem. Our conversation with Andrew Bacevich was produced and edited by Aaron Wee and Mary McGrath. It's part of an election year series we're calling How Fares the Land? Real America 2012. Put your own thoughts and diagnoses on our website at Radio Open Source and recommend your own cast of wise people we should be interviewing. You can follow what we're thinking and doing also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.